It is Wednesday. It is also 5 p.m. So that means it's time for American Hit Radio, WHPC 90.3. I'm your host every Wednesday and Friday between 5 and 6 p.m., my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales-Ryan.
I'm here.
Obviously here as well. When are you not here? I mean, whenever you're not here, I'm always forced to go into a five-minute excuse to explain your absence.
Making my excuses.
It has been said that if somebody sees me more than three times in the same year
Luckily,
without my wife.
This is radio and they don't have to see you at all.
If they can see me without you three times a year, I mean significantly, not like, oh, I'm in the car and you're in the store or something like that, because that technically we're together. But I mean, if one of us is out without the other one publicly more than three times a year and you catch us, I will buy you a car.
A used one.
A Yugo.
A Yugo.
If I could find one. Anyway. We've been going through this series, of course, for quite a while. By this series, I mean we are following one of two different lists that we are running simultaneously. One is called the Top 500 of the Top 40. The other is called the Alternative Top 40, or Top 500 of the Alternative Top 40. Both lists consist, obviously, of 500 albums, totaling 1,000, of course, again. One contains only albums that have made Billboard's top 40 albums. The other list contains albums that never did make the top 40. This is album number 65 of the top 500 of the top 40. It's an album that made it to the top 40, even though it was shunned by many and considered to be a failure by just about everyone. It is the sixth album released by the Monkees in December of 1968. It is also a soundtrack. It was called Head. Now, like almost everyone else in America, by 1969, even I had lost interest in the Monkees, who were my childhood heroes just 2 years earlier. The change in attitude could be attributed mostly to my increasing age. After all, at this point, I was almost a teenager already, so I considered myself too much. But there were other factors. The television show had ended. The implied bliss of the summer of love had become a wistful memory. And the music itself, around that time, started to develop.
The dew was off the bloom.
Yeah, the music was developing a harder edge in 1968 or 69. Even the Monkees seemed to be growing sick of themselves, or at least of what they represented. The film Head represented one of the most cynical pieces of cinematic art that you could imagine. But such was my indifference in 1969 that I didn't even bother to see the film until many years later. What a difference a couple of years can make. I mean, in 1967, the Monkees literally ruled the pop charts and controlled my own life. They held the number one spot for more than half of the year of 1967. But by the end of 1968, their relevance dwindled to the point where they almost virtually ceased to exist. What is remarkable about all of this is that the band retained its sense of humor and applied it to every aspect of their film. Head, as a movie, is relentlessly entertaining with incredible cameos by Sonny Liston, Frank Zappa, Victor Mature, and many others. Scene after scene has images of the band disparaging themselves, but the music held the film together by contradicting the self-inflicted insults. The Porpoise Song was the last 45 RPM single that I ever bought by the Monkees, but I loved it so much. Even then, as I was like losing my ability to want to admit that I still cared for the band, that it almost defies credulity that I wouldn't want to buy the album or see the film. But such was the drastic turn in my own personal culture. In my 20s, which is to say a full decade later, I sensed that I missed something and that I eventually wanted to catch up on what I might have passed on back then. So I bought a copy of the album and then the film. I loved the album, and the film was even better. I hope that you now can enjoy it as much as I have come to enjoy it myself, and that's exactly what we're going to try to do with this show. What makes this significant is that the Monkees, as everybody knows from their first album, were a creation, a false band thrown together for a TV show. They didn't know each other until they were brought together to be this performing act, to play a band in a sitcom. That, because the situation in the sitcom demanded songs, they were generally supplied to the band, with Mike Nesmith writing the occasional tune on their first couple of albums. Eventually, though, the Monkees seeked to be independent, and by their third album was granted that, and they made a great record called Headquarters. It sold quite well. The album after that, we also contained in this list. We covered albums 2, 3, and 4. We covered more of the Monkees, Monkees Headquarters, and the album Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones Limited. That is the album that contained Pleasant Valley Sunday on it and a bunch of other, like, just great songs.
Classics.
A fifth album, Birds and the Bees and the Monkees, began to, like, show signs of wear. And then by the time that Head came out, a lot of their audience was behind them. And the Monkees themselves realized that if they were really going to try to have any sort of credibility, then they needed to reject permanently the manufactured image that was thrust upon them. And that was what this movie was all about. It was about the Monkees aiming directly for the counterculture that was popular at the time. But what they didn't bet on was that the counterculture was going to be incredibly stubborn. They made their minds up about the Monkees 2 years earlier. They said that they were not cool. They didn't play their own instruments. They were not counterculture. They were part of...
Your own cousins used to tell you that, right?
Oh, yeah. My older cousins despised the band for that. All, you know, for all the wrong reasons, because all that stuff basically was not true. Most of them could play their own instruments. They certainly sang, and they did write a lot of their own material.
You hear that, Carolyn?
But now that the Monkees were making a movie aimed at the counterculture to try to win them all over, the counterculture wasn't paying attention. They weren't remotely interested. So the audience that they were aiming for thought that they were out of their minds and just disregarded the movie out of hand. The people who had been faithful to the band had lost interest. So the Monkees were basically singing and acting in a vacuum. Their audience was gone. So that's what makes this album interesting now, is because when you hear this after the fact, you begin to realize how incredible it is. The thing that held the movie together, as I said earlier, is the great music. Some of the best of it, written by Carol King and her husband, Jerry Goff, and also Harry Nilsson provided some of it. Peter Tork writing some of it. Michael Nesmith writing some of their own songs also. Made for just was a really interesting album. So let's start with the first two tracks from the soundtrack. The way this works is simple. They used a lot of dialogue from the movie on the record to more or less introduce the song and cut it. So what you're going to hear is what they call the opening ceremony, a scene where there is somebody dedicating a bridge in a formal manner. Mickey breaks through the line with the Monkees running after him, and Mickey runs out to the middle of the bridge and jumps off of the bridge, slams into the water, and is rescued by mermaids.
Awesome.
In the movie. It's a pretty cool scene when it happens, but that's what happens in the music. The song is called Porpoise Song, is the music that accompanied that scene.
Suspended arch bridges in the world.
Head.
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 Humming.
Head.
Humming.
Head.
What are you doing?
I mean, why don't we use plastic things? Millions!
Suck it before.
They're coming! They're coming!
$1 million head.
Hurry, that's enough. Let's cut it vertically. Pleasure, inevitable byproduct of our civilization. A new world, whose only preoccupation will be...
Suspended arch bridges in the world.
I'll tell you, one of the things that was one of the stranger things about being a young kid in the 60s was the way that it was so easy to get disoriented by the music that you were hearing.
I know. I wonder if they used real porpoise sounds for that.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Or if that was a Moog.
There's a huge amount of like effects, obviously, on the track and everything. That's Mickey Dolenz with Davy Jones singing in the background. The most prominent studio musician on that playing the organ, which is obviously the most obvious instrument in that song, that's Leon Russell.
Really?
Yeah, playing on that. But my point is, I can, you know, when 1968 is when I was begin to realize all of the bands that I liked that were pop bands in 66 were suddenly becoming something very, very different by 1968. It was a little, I mean, it was great, but it was also a little weird. If you were a 10-year-old kid and you saw the Beatles' White Album come out, you see those pictures of the Beatles looking really strung out and really
scraggly
and burnt out. I mean, it was definitely like, wow, there's definitely some sort of drug thing going on here. And the songs were strange too. Mm. Then, of course, the Bee Gees even began to follow suit, putting out an album like Odessa, which totally derailed me for a while. And the Monkees, who I absolutely loved, I bought this single, and I can distinctly remember sitting in my bedroom playing that song and finding it like sort of intoxicating, but also weird because it's so far away from Last Train to Clarksville, which it should be. You know, times change. These bands were reaching to do something different. But in the case of the Monkees, nobody wanted to hear it. I mean, the Bee Gees were experiencing a similar situation. If you were not considered cool in the earlier part of the decade, it was not going to be suddenly granted upon you.
You couldn't get in the club.
Yeah, that more or less, that door was sealed sometime around 67 or 68. The uncool bands were not going to suddenly be deemed cool. And this is why bands like the Monkees were suffering. They kind of knew it. And this next song, I think, more or less proves it. It's called Ditty Diego. And it's literally the Monkees singing a ditty about how they are perceived and how they basically are 100% aware of how they are perceived and how it's almost ironic to them that they're stuck in the middle of this whole situation. After that is a live version of the Monkees playing live, singing one of Mike's songs called Circle Sky. We'll play those two back to back.
Well,
are you kidding?
Hey, now, wait a minute.
Hey, we are the Monkees. You know we love to please. A manufactured image with no philosophies.
We hope you like our story, although there isn't one. That is to say, there's many. That way, there is more fun.
You've told us you like action and games of many kinds.
You like to dance, we like to sing, so let's all lose our minds.
We know it doesn't matter, because what you came to see is what we'd love to give you and give it 1, 2, 3.
But it may come 3, 2, 1, 2, or jump from 9 to 5. And when you see the end in sight, the beginning may arrive.
For those who look for meanings, in form as they do fact, we might tell you one thing, but we'd only take it back.
Not back like in a box back, not back like in a race, not back so we can keep it, but back in time and space.
You say we're manufactured. To that we all agree. So make your choice and we'll rejoice in never being free.
Hey, hey, we are the Monkees.
We've said it all before. The money's in, we're made of tin, we're here to give you more.
The money's in, we're made of tin, we're here to give you...
Spell.
you very much.
Mike
Nesmith, who I think is responsible for some of the best material that came out of the Monkees' collective works.
Did he play the guitar on that?
Wrote that one, played guitar on it, played organ on it.
How about that?
Of course, sings lead. Most of the other Monkees were not involved in that. In this instance, there were, I get this point, Mickey stopped trying to play drums. He just knew that he was never going to be as good as the studio cats who came in. So, and it was smart of him to do that. Do what he does best, you know. He was a good singer. That was fine. Now, there was one situation that came about. The Monkees knew that they were going to basically, with the TV show gone, they wanted to basically redo their image, rebuild it in a different way. So what they had done is they went to their producer's house, Bob Raffleson. And the four of them with Bob, apparently, as the story goes, they smoked an awful lot of substances and started writing down all of these crazy ideas about life as a monkey and about how it could be depicted on in a movie. And if you were going to be, not obviously, I know everyone wants to say, life as a monkey, swinging from trees. But as I mean it, it's just like, obviously, the band was in more or less a hopeless situation, and they figured that let's look at the funny side of this. Let's try to basically come up with a bunch of scenarios that would depict that. So they took notes on, in their stoned state. And what they more or less came up with was that they would constantly find themselves in totally absurd situations that were meaningless beyond belief, 100% out of their control. And they would always try to fight it. And every time they tried to fight the insanity that was surrounding them, they would somehow find themselves sucked into a black box. And they'd be stuck in the black box. And the black box was more or less meant to be the Monkees' universe. This is, you've got no say in who you are. You've got no say in what you do. Just when you leave the black box, the reality that you perceive belongs to us, not you. You are something that we control. So that's more or less what the movie is trying to convey. And the Monkees came up with a lot of funny ways to do it and say it with Bob Raffleson. Now, Bob Raffleson was going to be the, producing the movie, but he took what was done with the Monkees and he brought it to his buddy, Jack Nicholson. Yes, that Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson, at around this point in time, was allegedly, again, taking a lot of psychedelics. So he took the Monkees' ideas with Bob Raffleson, and the two of them wrote what was ultimately the screenplay. But then the Monkees realized that what these guys did was they just wrote in screenplay form all of the ideas that the Monkees had supplied. So the Monkees said, wait a minute, how come we're not on the screenplay? And they refused to give them any rights to the screenplay. It was exactly like the story that they were writing.
Oh, my God.
So they
life
actually
imitates
started...
art imitates life.
Right. So now they go to start filming of the movie, and the Monkees said, guess what? Make it without us. We're not showing up. So they had to start the movie without the Monkees. Finally, they had to make some sort of a settlement where the Monkees would at least get a better financial arrangement, more points, I guess, on the picture.
Right.
But Raffleson stayed hard about not giving them screenwriter rights. And from that point forward, after this movie, the Monkees had parted with him. That was it. That basically left bad blood.
Bad taste in their mouth.
But,
monkey mouths.
How ironic that you basically write something about how we're constantly getting controlled and we can't get credit for anything that we do. And that's what they basically face on the very movie that they were writing.
Crazy.
Incredible. This next song, again, all of this stuff kind of conveys parts of that. It's called Supplico. And after that, it segues, I'm sorry, Supplicio, excuse me. And after that, it will segue into a song written by Peter Tork, sung by Mickey Dolenz, and a whole bunch of other musicians, I guess, recording this track. It's called Can You Dig It?
Isn't it George Michael Dolenz? I said.
Peter Tork in full hippie mode on that track. Can you dig it? Peter, as you know, Peter was a big part of like the whole California, you know, crowd, the Monterey scene and everything else. I mean, he was roommates with Stephen Stills. You know, he was hanging out with the Mamas and the Papas, and he was an insider with all of those folks. The thing is, he was losing respect because he got famous, and everybody figured he got famous for all the wrong reasons. Like I said, once you were deemed to be on the other side of the cool wall, it was really hard to climb back over it, if possible at all. And I think that kind of bothered him. In fact, this is the very last album that Peter Tork appeared on by the Monkees. He quit after Head. That was it. So
because he wanted to be cool.
Well, I guess he it was really weird. It cost him a fortune to do it. He basically lost all of his money that he had made because he had to buy his way out. And it was not, I got to look it up, but if I remember correctly, it cost him like something like $75,000 a year, and he had to buy out 3 years of his contract.
Oh boy.
So he walked away from like $250,000 just to say goodbye.
That's crazy.
It was really terribly, again, it's really sad and it's not fair the way that they were treated, considering that they were making a lot of money for a lot of people. And the perception was really crazy. Now, as I said, a lot of this is about basically the Monkees kind of poking fun at themselves. And there are two really, really short bits right here, back to back, that I find both of them to be like laugh out loud funny. One is features Davy Jones walking into a diner and making an order, which I think is very funny. And the second one is called Superstitious, which is only once. Both of these two bits are only 7 seconds long each. Now, after Gravy and Superstitious, as they are called, we come to a song called As We Go Along. Earlier, I said they were written by Carole King and her husband, Jerry Goffin. I see I'm mistaken. I apologize for that. Actually, Carole King wrote this next song, As We Go Along, with Tony Stern. And what makes this interesting, again, all these like people that are too cool for school, like writing off the Monkees, this song is written in 5/8 time. And 5/8 is not an easy tempo to sing, not an easy tempo to perform. And yet Mickey handles it so well that even to this day, I bet you that there's about maybe 70% of the people who would attempt to sing this song would trip over the time signature, because it's very unusual. Meanwhile, the players on this record, check this out. This is unbelievable. The guitars are played by Carole King herself, Danny Cooch Korchmar, Ry Cooder, and the biggest surprise of all, Neil Young.
Wow.
Neil Young is on the show.
So not everybody was giving them short shrift.
They were happy to get the studio work, getting paid for it. This is at a time before Neil Young was in Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
He was just out of Buffalo Springfield. He was probably ended up at the studio trying to figure out what he was going to do to negotiate his own solo career at this point in time when this happened. On drums, though, New Orleans' own Earl Palmer.
Wow.
The drummer. Who else is going to play in 5/8 and do it gracefully, right? So there you have it. Then we're going to hear very quickly Gravy, Superstitious, and then this beautiful song called As We Go Along.
And I'd like a glass of cold gravy with a hare in it, please.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
Going back to my 10 or 11-year-old self in 1968 or 1969 with that 7-inch single. That was the B-side of the Porpoise song. And I liked it just as much. I just thought both sides were great.
It's a great song. It is a great song.
Yeah. So, I mean, here I am, like, giving up on the Monkees, but there's this one single that is somehow haunting me.
I can't believe that it didn't lead me to want to buy the album. I distinctly remember. I've got a very...
What was your guilty pleasure?
I got a very clear memory of going into like a store like Corvettes or something like that with my parents and having a budget for one album and seeing Head, this, you know, the silver album cover, I think it was made out of foil, on the wall, and picking it up and looking at it and ultimately just putting it back and buying something else. And I don't remember specifically what the something else was, but I was like, nope, not doing it. And it was almost
like... If only you could have gotten two albums.
Just the way that it went down. Because now it's funny, because like I said, this album is on this list because I do honestly believe that this is like one of the most entertaining albums of the past 40 years or so. You know, it's from December 1968, now being 2017. It's funny. The great songs are really captivating, and it's unique in the terms of like the story that it tells, because there's very few bands that would be able to do something like this with the amount of humor that the Monkees apply to it at the time. All right. I had mentioned that a lot of the movie is based around the Monkees constantly finding themselves trapped in a black box. And this is one of those situations where they are basically returned to another black box. But this time it's sort of filled up with like a bouncy bed. And they're sitting like, what are we? Where are we, man? What's going on? What is all this? And as they're standing there, like white flakes, it's like it starts snowing on them. And they're like, what's going on? And then they get a direction off screen like, hey, guys, just start jumping around. You're dandruff. Start acting like dandruff.
Oh, so they're in a hair commercial.
They're allegedly, right. So it's just like more flat out.
As in their commercial product.
Total, exactly. Total absurdity and them like getting more and more disgusted as this goes on. After that, we go to a song sung by Davy Jones that was written by Harry Nilsson. And it's also, again, telling because what Davy does is like a song and dance routine, top hat, cane, very much like what Davy was about as a Monkee. But the song's lyrics are about a father abandoning his family, leaving his children behind. And Davy is singing this in this, you know, in this upbeat sort of a way that basically adds to the irony of the situation. Hmm. It's really funny because in the movie, after that scene, you see Davy walking down the street of the studio with, of all people, Frank Zappa. And Davy and Frank Zappa are walking together, pulling a cow with a bell on his neck, if I remember correctly. And it's Frank Zappa essentially giving Davy Jones professional advice. Like Davy's, like, says, so what do you think of the song? And Frank says, like, oh, it was pretty white. And he starts telling him that he maybe ought to think about, you know, what he does artistically and stuff like this. And of course, this is a real self-aware moment. This isn't like this is happening to the Monkees and they're not aware of it. They put it in their own movie.
Of course.
Now, it was exactly them making the statement about themselves. So anyway, here's those two bits, dandruff into Daddy's song.
Supernatural, perhaps.
Change one tape, the entire process is re-geared. Pleasure. The inevitable byproduct of our civilization. Tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want.
Out.
Oh, out. Get out of here.
Hey, what's going on?
I'm gonna move it. Out.
Oh, hello, officer. Certainly glad to...
Shut up. Okay, weirdos.
All right, fellas, will you come forward, please?
Who's that?
All right, now jump up and down a little.
Jump
fellas,
this?
Get lost
what
in it. There you go. Very good. Look, you're supposed to be dandruff, fellas. Will you work at it, please? Jump up and down
dandruff.
A little bit.
Good. Dandruff.
That's better.
Dandruff.
That's good. Good.
Dandruff.
That's better.
Dandruff.
That's good. Good.
Dandruff.
Years ago I knew a man. He was my mother's biggest fan. We used to walk beside the sea, and he told me how life would be when I grew up to be a man. Years ago we used to play. He used to laugh when I ran away. But when I fell and hurt my knee, he would run to comfort me, and the pain would go away. We'll be right back. under a board. He was his daddy's pride and joy. But when the daddy went away, it was such a rainy day that he brought out all his sons. How the mama did explain, trying to take away the pain. But he just couldn't understand that his father was not a man, and it all was just a game. So have I, making it hard for me to cry. And if and when I have a son, let it all be said and done, let the sadness pass him by.
It's sad to think that of all the monkeys, Davy was by far the most disparaged as being uncool.
And that must have been why I had the biggest crush on him.
But who would have guessed back then, because he was also like the baby face of the band, that he would have been the first to pass, if, you know, so much ahead of the others. You know, God rest his soul. The monkeys have been touring and recording albums lately without him. And apparently their last record together, with the three of them, has gotten excellent reviews. Some great songwriters contributed to their last album, including like Andy Partridge of XTC. Some great alternative writers gave them some material on the album, and it's an excellent record. And it's just funny how things come full circle. It's just really too bad that Davey wasn't there to witness at least the artistic comeback of the band, if not the commercial comeback. All right, then, I was talking a little bit about Davy and Frank Zappa walking down the street. This next track has got, basically, again, it's a spoken track where all of the monkeys are involved talking here. And you will hear, if you listen closely, you'll hear Frank Zappa on this first section as well, called Pole. And that then goes into a track with two songs called Long Title. And then the song is called Do I Have to Do This All Over Again? Now, again, check this out. I mentioned that Neil Young had played earlier on that one track, and mm-hmm. I had mentioned that this is right around the same time that Buffalo Springfield broke up. Well, on this track, the guitar parts are all played by Peter Tork and Stephen Stills.
His roomie.
Right. And the drums are by Dewey Martin, who was the drummer for Buffalo Springfield.
Oh, crazy.
So here you are. You basically got Buffalo Springfield is supplying a lot of the instrumental backing for this Monkees album, Head. What do you know?
Well, they weren't doing anything else.
And here are those two tracks.
The song was pretty white.
And I'll tell you something else, too. The same thing goes for Christmas.
Crazy.
Boys, don't never, but never make fun of no cripples.
Somebody come up and giggle at you. That's a violation of your civil rights.
Gun bait. That's what the world is full of. That's what it's based on. That's what this economy is based on.
Are you telling me that you don't see the connection between government and laughing at people?
Well, let me tell you one thing, son. Nobody ever lends money to a man with a sense of humor.
Thank you.
place by itself. I know life's more than just some kind of deal. Yeah, but won't you tell me when all of my soul comes off the shelf?
Speaking of belief, beliefs and conditioning.
Oh, right. That would be a long title, Do I Have to Do This All Over Again? I just had a really, ridiculously, my insight by minutia for when that song was playing. I'm listening to the rhythm guitar track of the song we just heard. And I'm saying to myself, I know that that is the Stephen Stills part because I'm such a Stephen Stills fan, but a lot of people might be familiar with this, with a relatively obscure album. After Buffalo Springfield broke up and before Stephen got involved in Crosby, Stills, and Nash, he was part of an album called Super Session. Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield were the other two main names on the record. It was an Al Kooper record that was supposed to be Al and Mike Bloomfield, and Mike Bloomfield was only available for half of the album, so they brought Stephen Stills in to do the second half. And on that, they do a Dylan song, they do Season of the Witch and such, and there's a certain tone to Stephen Stills' guitar. And I'm hearing the rhythm track on that song, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is recorded right about the exact same time. Maybe within weeks of when Super Session went down, Stephen Stills was here recording with the Monkees and then recording on that Super Session album. So, huh. And I can just tell by the tone of the guitar. It's such a weird little minutia point, but there it is. All right, the album ends with a rather strange mashup of a whole bunch of different spoken parts and some, I guess what you could call incidental music. This Ken Thorne wrote the incidental stuff, by the way. He's the same guy that provided all of the incidental music for the Beatles album Help. So we'll play that. And this is about 5 minutes long, the longest piece on the record. A weird one, but it's called Swami Plus Strings.
We were speaking of belief, beliefs and conditioning. All belief possibly could be said to be the result of some conditioning. Thus, the study of history is simply the study of one system of beliefs deposing another, and so on and so on and so on. A psychologically tested belief of our time is that the central nervous system, which feeds its impulses directly to the brain, the conscious and subconscious, is unable to discern between the real and the vividly imagined experience. If there is a difference, and most of us believe there is, am I being clear? For to examine these concepts requires tremendous energy and discipline. To experience the now without preconception or belief, to allow the unknown to occur and to occur, requires clarity. But where there is clarity, there is no choice. And where there is choice, there is misery. But then why should anyone listen to me? Or should I speak?
already go?
Since I know nothing.
The whole violent thing is happening. I mean, why don't we use plastic things? Millions!
Suck it, people. Before the venom reaches my heart.
Okay, I will.